Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together? Is my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello and welcome to Tyson Jacks. I'm out, Ricardo on the board. SB Futures. Down 35, NASDAQ futures down 220. That's not good. It's before the big jobs report. We've been kind of wobbly the last week or so. Market did not look like it's all that healthy right here. I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but the reasons have been here for a while. So it's one of those things, Ricardo. You never exactly know the quote reasons, but you can. But all day long, you have to find a reason. That's what people want you to do. So even though there might be all kinds of reasons, so it could be like, you know. Market down is say Carl comes out of the can, you know, that could be the reason. We're not sure, but that's true. It's down, and he just came out of the can. Carl, are you with us?
Oh, you got me.
Oh yeah, well, you're.
Carl's logged in too.
I'm logged in, but I thought I was 8 o'clock.
You are. I'm just staring at the jobs report. I'm getting it ready for you, so your name was on the top of my head. How's that?
Oh, all right. Well, I'll go back to lurking in the corner and let Kevin have it.
Okay. Yeah, you can jump in anytime, though. Yeah, anytime you want to, chime in because you have a good deep thought, feel free.
I was just looking here, since we're talking about a little bit of stocks and jacks, and we'll be talking about labor later, I'm looking at the top 25 largest football stadiums. That's interesting. Michigan maintains their number one, eh? Then they went up to 107,601.
Good for them.
Yeah, and then Penn State is number two. If you ever want to see something interesting, Kevin, you've probably seen it. The iteration of the stadium, say 30 or 40 years ago, and how they just kept adding on to the thing. So it'll show you the stadium 1 year, and the next year it's got this balcony, and 2 years later it's got that balcony. It's pretty interesting, the iterations where they kept stuffing seats into place.
Well, it is interesting, but it's not great.
No, well, it's add on.
and it feels like it when you're there, and there's a lot of funky hallways and just weird ways. The concourses are generally smaller, so that makes it when people go to concession stands, which you probably shouldn't anyway. My kids were very well trained. Dad ain't buying crap at the
isn't that the truth? Well, it's Ohio State would be third, a virtual tie with Texas A&M, where we just saw the Irish play last week. LSU is 102. I didn't realize that. Now, my guys last night, when I brought up this question, of course, my guys, they have that combination of, like, knowing nothing but being very opinionated. Absolutely would have bet me anything in that they had or I had that Tennessee was now the biggest. It's not. It's number six. What at 101?
It's huge, though.
It's over 100,000. Alabama's 101.8. Texas is 100. So we've got eight over 100 now. Then you drop down to the 90s. Actually, there's only two in the 90s. This is weird.
And you wonder why college football doesn't want to let go of its business model.
Yeah. Well, there's only two in the 90s, which is kind of surprising. After being eight in the hundreds. Georgia is 92. I didn't realize the Rose Bowl was 91. I thought the Rose Bowl was 100. I'd be wrong. Rose Bowl is 91 because they count that for UCLA goes all the way out there to play their games.
Yep.
It's got to be how many miles?
It's a track.
Yeah. Then you got in the high 80s. You got Florida, Auburn, Nebraska.
But nobody's going to go. Nobody goes to UCLA games anyway. So.
Well,
put it wherever you want.
Then in the 80s, you've got Florida, Auburn, Nebraska, Clemson, Notre Dame, Oklahoma. So it kind of drops down after these big, huge teams.
And you had all kinds of people in the '70s. Michigan State, Wisconsin, Arkansas, Southern Cal. Now Southern Cal counts Memorial Coliseum, and it's 77,000. My I talk about years and years ago, my uncle who used to put in and fix, well, a lot of people did, in his crew, huge printing presses. There was some kind of a printer right near the Coliseum. This is long before the neighborhood got crummy. I guess it's okay again, but boy, talk about a pig and slap, Kevin. He would go out there and he'd tell him, oh, it's okay, I'll stay the weekend. He'd see UCLA play Friday night. He'd see Southern Cal on Saturday and the Rams on Sunday. He got to see all three games, and the dude just loved football. He's one of those guys. So he'd stay at some hotel like two blocks from the place and just walk over. You couldn't have found a happier weekend for a guy. I did a little too much football for me, but some people really love it. Anyway, so that's where that all is. What do you make of this market sliding down here?
Soldier Field doesn't hold many now, but I'm searching right now because it seems to me that they had a record crowd for a Notre Dame game. Might have been Southern California. Let's see, history of Soldier Field. Notre Dame has enjoyed success at Soldier Field.
I'm gonna give you two numbers. I'm gonna say the biggest crowd was at a high school prep bowl game.
Could have been.
And the actual biggest crowd was Billy Graham speaking. There was like 200,000 people or something. But they used the field.
Well, then you're using the field. The biggest crowd, 1927, they had 123,000 there. So it used to be a rather different configuration. And then when the Bears moved in, they put these stands on one end because it was a really, really long oval.
Track and field.
Yeah, it was built for track and field, but it was built for some games or another, you know.
I'm going to say the Pan American games.
Yeah, it could have been the Pan American games, but whatever it was, they put temporary stands, you know, so they moved the football field to one end of the stadium, put up temporary stands, then they changed the stadium to actually build a mini stadium on one side and the football stadium on the other side. They'd have things like tennis and those kinds of sports in the mini stadium. And finally, they tore down the mini stadium, kind of enclosed it, and that became Soldier Field up until they had the two-year redo several years ago to really make it look weird.
Where did they play in that period of time? They weren't back at Wrigley, were they?
They played at Illinois, University of Illinois.
Oh, that's right. We got to put the skyboxes in, you know. The definition.
It was a rather substantial reconfiguration.
Oh, yeah. It was a full rebuild.
It looks stupid as hell. You know, I've heard it described two ways. It either looks like a giant spaceship landed in Soldier Field, or it looks like someone built a giant toilet seat on top of Soldier Field. If you're looking at it from
the whole idea was to maintain the idea, the pillars and stuff that were the landmark status of Soldier Field. So the pillars.
I mean, that wasn't the idea, that was the constraint.
Well, now, as soon as they finished it, whoever does landmark places said, you screwed up so bad it's no longer a landmark.
That's right. So they spent a lot of money and sacrificed a lot of capacity just to maintain the landmark status, only to have it revoked for despoiling the landmark.
Well, the. As we talk an awful lot on the show about economics, and I shudder. I hope it's because they're having an adult beverage. My people I hang with are absolutely convinced that if the Bears had, you know, the poor Bears are being brutalized by this 68,000 capacity, and yet they're absolutely convinced.
I think it's more like 58, isn't it?
We could look. I think it's in the 60s, I think. But anyway, Ricardo, why don't you look that up for us? Capacity of Soldier Field. Everybody's absolutely convinced that if it held 500,000 people, that they would get the same ticket prices.
Soldier Field is about 61,500 people.
There you go. I know it was in the 60s, barely, Kevin. But anyway.
Polished by NFL standards, regardless.
Yeah. So everybody's convinced that if you had, now they have the two layers of skyboxes, right, where most of the money is. The one gentleman that I knew a long time ago had the number one skybox in the place, one or two, right on the 50. And he, I think they were $2,000 a ticket back then, plus food. This had to be 12 years ago. We're talking, you know, serious cash for these things. But anyway, remember when the Blackhawks went from 19,000 in the old stadium, where they had like a good team, and went to 23,000 in the new stadium, and all of a sudden you could get a ticket. How many years were they down to like 5 or 6 showing up, Kevin? Or 8 or something? You got to be careful. I mean, if all of a sudden, you know, the Soldier Field went to 90,000 and everybody get a ticket, what makes you think anybody would be there?
They better have a good team, that's for sure.
What do you have any idea? What are the status of the people with the seats, that bought the seats thing? Are they still trading the seat licenses?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
What do they do there?
Ricardo, if you're bored over there, kick up Soldier Field seat licenses or Bear seat licenses, see if there's actually a market for those things.
Well, he's sitting there listening to you and me. He's got to be bored.
He's got to be bored. Well, all right, so let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the Fed, this huge labor adjustment a couple weeks ago. I'm sure Carl's going to be all over that one when we're on, is how it affects the numbers today. We've got they're expecting 161,000, which is lower than it has been. We'll see what the revision is, because now people are looking at the revisions and they're saying, hey, revisions are always down, or seem like they're always down. Therefore, these guys are really messing with the numbers and blah, blah, blah. And you know, it doesn't surprise me that somebody's messing with numbers, Kevin. But how accurate do you think, you know, you and I are come from a school, and when you did a random survey, you actually had to do something. I was watching TV last week, and they came out with this survey that this is maybe a month ago, that Trump was ahead of Harris. Nationwide. And then I do something you should never do, Kevin, and frush you all the time, because you do it all as well. I read it in detail, and it was a survey of 1,000 likely voters nationwide. And I sit there and go, how the bleep could you get a nationwide random sample of 1,000 people? What table would you even use? What list of people would you use? And how the hell would you find them? And how could you?
Tom, I'm sure it can be done, but when you know, your sample size is going to have a lot to do with your margin of error too. That tends to make your results at least questionable. And I think that's always an important note.
Well, if your sample size is 20,000. And you actually hit a pretty good list to start with, and you bleep up on 10 of them or 15 of them and don't get the right person, which kind of blows the randomness, you're probably still okay. But if you're talking about 1,000 out of 200 million, if you don't get one right person, when you're talking about 1% and 2% differences,
what do you mean one right person?
I mean if somehow or another, I identify Kevin O'Neill as my random guy. And I go to your house, I stake out your car, and finally I can't find you. I said, screw it, I'll ask the neighbor. You just blow the whole survey, right?
Oh, but that isn't what they do, is say, screw it, I'll ask the neighbor. Is they build the sample, and then if you get a non-respondent, then you've got somebody else in the sample. So you actually can pad your list to maintain the randomness of it. Now, again, I'm not telling you that all the polls are accurate or that they get it right. I'm not telling you they don't slant them, because they do. A lot depends on the question you ask. So there's a lot more to it, but it's not like you say, "Oh, the hell with it, I'll just go next door."
Well,
they don't do that, because that will invalidate the sample.
But if you find that you can't find 50 people out of the 1,000 at a certain time of day, those people might all be working at night for some reason and economically have a problem, and maybe would vote for somebody third party. How would you even know? I mean,
you wouldn't. So what you do is part of your sample is people you call during the day, people you call during the night. And it may be that you don't, you know, if you have 1,000 and 50 don't answer, it may be that you don't have a waiting sample of additional 50. Maybe, I don't know if your sample goes down to 950 or how that works. But, you know, they know how to do it. The public polls are, you know, take them for what they're worth. They're not great. The politicians have internal polling, and those tell them a lot more.
How do you suppose they do those?
They pay for better sampling techniques and more details.
But I mean, there's a whole class of people now. I don't know why this is, but I'm kind of more likely. I haven't had a landline in a year. I had one up till about a year ago. And who knows? I might get another one again. But I'm kind of more likely to answer some questions on the landline because I really don't want my phone going off when I'm talking to a client. I think there's a stigma to your cell phone, for lack of a different term, your smartphone versus the landline. I don't know why I feel it's a little less intrusive there. Or maybe I give the people a break that are doing it, but I'm not giving anybody a break if they call me when I'm on the phone with a client. I mean, there's a difference just in how you go about it, I think, Kevin. I don't know what the... I guess what I'm saying is the smaller the sample, the more accurate you better be on the randomness. And how you get 1,000 people randomized out of 300 and some million people country, I wouldn't begin to where to start on that. And how do you...
And I wouldn't get too excited about just a random poll of 1,000 people anyway. I'd feel much better about seeing 10,000 or, you know, whatever. But they do what they do.
Well, I was stunned that once in a while we make a great call at Stocks and Jacks, Kevin. Market's kind of hard to call, but we made the call. I don't know if you weren't as adamant about it as I was, but our Stocks and Jacks reporters absolutely had the Brexit stone cold knockdown. We said they were going out. We had a couple guys from the Fed that were over there and with these big meetings in London. And in London, it was a slam dunk. He says as soon as he went out of town, nobody was voting to stay. And I don't know how
we have spoken this very week about how disconnected people in the political centers are from the average person. So a lot of times, the sense that you get, just being around normal folks is going to be a lot different than the sense you get. And one of the things that's come up with polls too is there's a lot of people that don't want to answer questions that they or they're willing to lie about it, and that's got to be built into your sampling as well, and that's part of your margin of error. So it's because a lot of people resent pollsters. So
yeah, why do you think? I mean, it's been a long time since I was on board of the SIBO and actually was in Washington a couple times a year and got to meet a lot of these people. Well, not a lot. I mean, there's 500 some people. I'm there for two nights, so I meet 10 of them. But you get to meet, and I really did get, Kevin, a sense of that the Constitution, wasn't all that screwed up. It seemed to me that there was a huge difference, in general, not individuals are hard to say, between the people that were in the House and the people who are in the Senate. And certainly the people who work for like the SEC and stuff, which I don't even want to go into. Talk about not having a clue. But the people in the House, if you meet somebody from, Carolina or Indiana or Indiana or someplace, they are, this is, 25 years ago, but still, they're absolutely in touch with their people, it seemed to me. I mean, you're running every 2 years. I mean, you always got to be out doing something. I mean, unless you manage to be in some city where you can actually never be here and just your name, you win every time. I can name a few here, but I won't.
Right. Once you've been there 20 years, you're probably gonna, you don't have to work as hard to get reelected, so you don't spend as much time in your district.
But I thought most people were pretty well connected. I mean, the idea that it is, every 2 years you can get your butt rousted out. I'm going to say, a Mike Quigley was way more connected just by the design of it than, You know, but then again, you can become like Nancy Pelosi. Even though she's in a house, nobody even runs against her. I don't know how connected she ever was. But if you're actually in a district that has some people that watch what you're doing and somebody runs against you, I think a House member has to be pretty connected, don't you? That doesn't mean they have any power. And it doesn't mean that they're in the State Department or the Treasury Department or that kind of stuff. But at least there's somebody there that should have some connection, don't you think?
Yeah, well, that's part of your smaller government argument is, anytime you get government closer to the people involved, then you start to have a little bit better better representation and to some degree better decision making. But then you get the question of in a district, who are the zealots? Who are the people that are really going to vote versus who are the people that have an opinion? So then you get your AOCs, who I am not sure represents her district very well. She's pissed off her people in her district a lot, but not enough to have opposition that'll go after her, although her fellow squad members have taken some hits this most recent election cycle. So maybe that's buttressing your point.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that... I don't know anything about her district, so I mean, I have no idea. She might... I don't know. She tended bar in the district, and she probably knows someone. I don't know anything about her other than she talks. She's out there in her speech, and she's hot. Other than that, I don't.
Sometimes the personality can defeat the looks.
Oh yeah. Well, what do you say? He or she looked pretty good till they opened their mouth. that does happen. Yeah. That does happen. Well, we got the football starting. Both Lou and two contributors of the show, Lou and Audrey, both said that when Brazil X'd out the X, that we should have pulled the football game.
Well, it's been going on longer than that, so that's just another in a series of examples of the government censorship in there. And you know what? I mean, we canceled an All-Star game in Atlanta because... we couldn't abide with people showing IDs to vote.
Yeah.
But now we got a different league that is perfectly willing to hang out in Brazil, despite the fact that they're worried about safety and security of the athletes while they're there, and that we have all these censorship stuff. I'm willing to bet that there won't be a word said about it on the broadcast.
Well, have you been following... the last few days, this huge hue and cry regarding, for those that don't know, U.S. Steel has been bid to purchase by, Nippon Steel?
Yeah.
And it's interesting now that the Biden administration is saying they don't think they want to do that, let that happen. And and I know you guys always talk about everything being left-wing, but the business news, I'm not going to say it's right-wing, but it is so pro- chief executive business, not like worker business or anything like that. I mean, it's disgusting to listen to it. But I mean, the whining and the sniveling over the last 5 days about this administration having the nerve to stop like the CEOs there from getting this big bonus from Nippon. I'm going to say, Kevin, I remember Trump's campaign when he won, and one of the things I really liked about it was he would never allow this to happen, would he?
Well, he's saying he won't now, too.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I sort of see. I don't see the same as what you're seeing. You're probably so immersed in the investment, in people involved in investments that you may be seeing it differently than I am, and that's not a bad thing. It's not. I'm not criticizing what I'm saying is, I don't know a lot of people who think it's a good idea to outsource. To put the steel industry in foreign hands, even though it's a friendly country, the question always is going to be what industries strategically need to be U.S.-based industries.
Well, I don't. There's a couple questions here that maybe we'll talk all the numbers with Carl, but is it possible if you and I all of a sudden hit 15 lotteries in a row, could we just go buy Toyota? I don't know. Can we? Would Japan allow that to happen?
I don't know if they would or not. I don't know what Japan's policies are on foreign ownership of their most treasured companies.
I just, you know, the reason why I have this incredibly disgusted view of this whole mess, Kevin, is, you know, obviously I was in the trading industry for a long time, and I still can't believe it. We have no competition, very little competition in that industry. Like, we used to have thousands of people doing it. And there was a guy at the Board of Trade. I don't think he was there when it actually got taken over. They gave the guy a contract, Kevin, where he had all these stock options, and if the place got taken over at some price over some price, he got like 20% of the nut. Kevin, the place has been there 150 years. The dude was going to be there 2 weeks, and his job was to sell it, so the top level of people got all this boon. I think that when somebody bought like Ryerson and those places, those people all got screwed out of their pension to a large extent. I mean, so I'm not so sure that somebody doesn't need to interview Nippon and say, by the way, what are your views on pensions? I mean, you can do a lot to screw pensioners.
I thought legally I get that you can do a lot, but don't legally they have to maintain it?
They can maintain it, but
keep it funded. They don't have to continue it, but...
Well, the guys yeah, I think... I know the guys who bought...
Oh, Carl, go ahead.
Yeah, who bought... Well, I don't know if you ever... The case of Rheem Manufacturing. Remember those... I don't know if you were on the South Side or Kevin, but it's a massive hot water heater plant on Kedzie, like 76 Rheem. And, they had, I don't know how many... I don't know if they were two shifts, three shifts, but it was a big place. And all of a sudden, I think they got bought by somebody in the somebody gave everybody the opportunity to relocate to, like, God knows where, Mexico. I don't know. If it wasn't Mexico, it was almost as bad. When people said no, they used that as a reason to screw their pension. Well, you know, you quit.
Oh, no. And then you have the PBGC.
Yeah.
So you could just simply bankrupt the pension fund. Ah. And oh, by the way, go talk to an airline pilot that got... you want to talk about getting bent over the table? That was about as bad as it ever gets. The government comes in if they declare it insolvent, and then, you know, whatever's there ends up getting distributed to the pensioners ultimately. Problem with that is,
but it's just like every other bankruptcy proceeding. You're not going to get paid full value, are you?
Oh, not even close. And the thing is that even what never happens is no one ever goes to jail for deliberately shorting the reserves, okay, on the way out the door for the 10 years prior. So in the case of the airlines, there were people that got 10 or 15 cents on a dollar.
Plus, I think if you give somebody the option to retire early and then the pension fund goes under, doesn't the federal law say you owe the money back if you weren't 65 or some crazy thing?
It's a bizarre setup, but I will say this. The good news with the PBGC is that it's a pool. It's basically an insurance pool, okay, like any other insurance pool, right? The bad news is that the people that did the malfeasant thing in the first place never get punished. Okay, now, you know, things do happen that are not the cause of malfeasance. But look, this steel thing in particular is a huge issue, because if we do not have the ability in the United States to create primary steel, and by the way, Nucor is not a primary steel provider. That's not what they do. They don't take iron ore.
Those are the guys who had Ryerson and Inland, right?
They're basically recyclers.
Yeah, but where did the Ryerson to Inland to somebody? Who did Inland go to? Was it Nucor?
I don't remember that one, but yeah. So we used to, back when we used to actually make things in the United States, we used to take iron ore, which we still have a lot of. We used to ship it down. You know, the magic of this was that it went down the Great Lakes. I mean, hello, Edmund Fitzgerald,
yep.
Right? Went down the Great Lakes, and some of it stopped in the Detroit area. Hello, Zug Island. Okay, well, gee, I wonder why. Weren't they doing something like making cars with it, I think? Right? Got turned into... Right, and then the rest ended up in places like Pittsburgh and,
Northwest Indiana.
Right, yeah. And the thing is that all of that iron ore got turned into steel. That steel got turned into things. Bridges, cars, tanks, if you happen to need them. Today, all those furnaces, they're gone. Now, was there a pollution issue with that and things like that? Yes, there were environmental issues. There absolutely were. If we actually need steel, could we make it today? Maybe not. How about the same thing with aluminum? Gee, you don't need aluminum for things like airplanes, right?
Gary Works will still make it. There aren't very many.
Well, but, you know, I mean, Alcoa was, you know, gee, hello. they even named a town after him. It's right down the road from me.
Well,
we're back on the topic of what are the strategic industries that we must have operating in the United States for long-term viability. So everybody wants to go overseas to save some money, which, you know, I sort of get what they do, but the question becomes then, at what point are you putting the U.S. economy at risk?
You're not putting the U.S. economy.
We learned a lot about that when they did all the COVID nonsense, because there was so much stuff that was made in China that we could.
Or are there any antibiotics made here anymore? Are they all in?
No, there are no antibiotics made with. Well, the precursors at least are not made in the United States, and that, by the way, would be very difficult to stand up on a rapid basis if it became necessary. Like, for example, if there was somebody shooting at us, there is. When you look at what happened during COVID, you couldn't make a car because some of the chips that had to go into the computer could not be sourced as a result of the COVID insanity, right? Now, that was not because they weren't being made in the United States. It's because they aren't made in the United States. You don't need to have chips like that to be able to make things like, anti-tank missiles, as an example.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really important, right? I mean, you really wouldn't think that one of our main economic adversaries, you know, so however you feel about China, the fact is they're an economic adversary. They could turn into a real no BS one. And if they did, that would be really unfortunate if we couldn't make anything to fight a war against them with.
Well, how many people get...
And so what happens if they roll into Taiwan, where, you know, over half of the world's semiconductors are made?
Well,
that could be a little bit of a problem.
More than a little bit, yeah. And by the way, we're
not as bad off as the euro. So, U.S. I think we produce something like 20% of them. You know, different chips matters, but qualities and purposes matter. But we're about 20%. You go to the European Union; they're about 8% of the world chip market. How screwed would they be?
Kevin, we couldn't produce a Tomahawk right now. In-house, completely in-house. We couldn't do it. There are 100 things that we could not make here in country without that sort of thing. By the way, it takes about 10 years to stand a fab up with the current production stuff.
Yeah, and even when you get it up and running, it's going to be low yield for a while.
Right, it takes time to get everything ramped up and to... This is not something. How long does it take to actually build a steel mill? You know, I mean, I grew up a few miles from one. It was open hearth in the middle of the night when they opened up the stuff and did their pours. It was really pretty. I'm sure it was also really terrible for the environment. But the fact of the matter is that if we needed to make a tank, we could.
Do we have any of the? Oh, I'm sure we have some. Do we have very many of the? What's the new? Not the open hearth. What's the one that came after that?
They're called oxygen furnaces. It's an electric arc system. It's different than the open hearth. But yeah, same idea.
That's what the recyclers use, isn't it?
There are differences though, and you really can't do one with the other. It's a serious issue because, you know, environmentalism is all fine and well. But, you know, it's like this. By the way, Biden said the quiet part out loud on an open mic. One of the problems with dementia is you don't remember when you're supposed to keep your mouth shut. He said point blank that the Inflation Reduction Act was not called the right thing. It should have been the Green New Deal, because there's $300 billion that he got to spend on that stuff. And oh, by the way, it deliberately produced inflation, and he admitted this.
Yeah, that was like a year and a half ago, yeah.
Well, yeah, but do we really want to call everybody?
And he did, you're right. He said it's really not, you know, it's not properly named. Yeah, no kidding.
Well, it was the thing that stripped away half the rights that we have. Should that really have been called the Patriot Act?
Well, obviously not. But, I mean, you know, here we are, and oh, by the way, the person who is directly responsible, and I've gone after some people on the GOP side because, you know, Massey, for example, loves to say how he is against, you know, much of this government waste and, you know, things like this, right? He was the vote in the committee to report one of these bills, these crazy, you know, 5,000-page things you can't actually read before you vote on it. He was the deciding vote in the committee to send that thing to the floor. But for his single vote, it would not have ever been considered or passed. And the same thing with Harris. She wants to be president of the United States. She was the single deciding vote in the Senate on this so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which shoved a big one right up everyone's backside.
Well, how about we go to break real quick? SP Futures down 33, NASDAQ Futures down 201. We probably won't do a second break because right before right before the labor numbers, but we'll do one here, and we'll be right back with our two guests and Ricardo on the board.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our Better Business Bureau A-rated team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Call now for a free case review and a low price guaranteed quote to get you protected today. Call now. 800-388-4901. That's 800-388-4901. U.S. Tax Shield. 800-388-4901.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Ricardo on the board. SP Futures down 33. We were actually up a hair last night for a little bit, and not so now. NASDAQ Futures down 202, so we're continuing. Now, this will all change when the jobs report comes out, but everybody thinks it's going to be a clunker because of the revision last week or 2 weeks ago. Dow Futures down 161, individual stocks, Amazon down 205, Home Depot down $1.30, and just everybody's pretty much red. Microsoft down 239. Over in Asia, we have a phenomenon here this morning in Asia. You don't see too often since my machine wants to move. The Nikkei, I think, well, seem to have frozen things up. Oh, no, there we go. We're gonna These 20-year-old computers that I use for this stuff, they get old. It's like us. Nikkei down 265.7%, 36,391. But get this, Hang Seng was actually unchanged, 17,444. Shanghai down 2765, maybe going to go under 2750. China just seems to be in a bad way. DAX down 75.4%, FTSE down 23.3%, CAC down 11.1%, so not much. So down, but not very much over in Europe. Yesterday, Dow was down 2.19, S&P's down 16, and NASDAQ did have a reek out a little bit of a gain, a little bit of a dead cat bounce there on the big seven. It was up 43. Bonds down 3 basis points, 3.70. They went down 4 basis points, 2.17. Japan down 3 basis points, 0.84. Oil up 24 cents, but still under $70, $69.39. Brent up 24, $72.93. Natural gas up a penny, $2.26. RBOB up a penny, $1.94. Gold, which has come back here a little bit, back up over 2,500, up 4.60 today. Silver up 2 cents, $29.12. Copper up a penny, $4.15. Foreign exchange, still 111, almost exactly on the euro, 131 on the pound, so not much change there. And we have Bitcoin down 159, 55,931. Carter, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports? Not much. Well, we have football. No Cubs.
Morning, Chief. No Cubs yesterday, but we do have a game today. Right now it's 6:44 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 68 degrees right now with a high of 68. Breezy and cooler with periods of clouds and sunshine. A shower in the area this afternoon, and it's supposed to be the start of a stretch of cooler weather, so that's nice. Tonight will be mostly cloudy, windy, and cooler with a low of 54 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 94 degrees right now with a high of 111. It's breezy this morning, otherwise mostly sunny and hot. The heat will be dangerous, so try to minimize outdoor activity. Tonight will be clear and very warm with a low of 89 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 18 minutes. We're looking at 39 minutes inbound Edens from Lynn Cook, inbound Eisenhower from Wall, 52 minutes, inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes, and Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 29 minutes. Lastly, sports yesterday. We got the Diamondbacks losing to the Giants 2-3, and today we got a couple of games. Cubs play the Yankees at 1:20 p.m. The White Sox play the Red Sox at 6:10 p.m. and the Diamondbacks play the Astros at 7:10 p.m. NFL, the kickoff was yesterday. The Chiefs beat the Ravens 27-20, and today we got the Packers and the Eagles taking a trip down to Sao Paulo, Brazil, where they're going to be playing at the Corinthians Arena at 7:15 p.m., I guess as an effort to globalize American football. And what better place to start than the 8th largest economy in the world, right? Lastly, Sunday, we got the Bears playing the Titans at 12 p.m., and the Cardinals playing the Bills at 12 p.m. as well. That's all I got for you, Chief.
Guys, just as a bear with me here for a second, just a little bit of a review. I was somewhat, I won't say involved, but I was at Pullman, and Pullman had their own defined benefit plan, which you don't see too many of those anymore except for maybe cities. And this was back in 77. Okay, so if you recall how the economics matched up, from 68 on, people were getting pretty much more higher than interest rates than you would ever predict it, right? So your pensions were all done by these ERISA laws, which I'm sure you guys remember, but you know, never read them. And our friend Robin, our dear departed friend Robin, she used to be a contributor. Anyway, she was at a very young age. Robin was a brilliant lady. She was on the Pullman Pension Board. And this board, the number one, I'll ask you guys, but I know you don't know the answer. What's the first number you come up with that keys everything else if you're on a pension board and you're looking how much to put in the pension going forward?
I don't know. You tell me.
We're going to pick a rate that we think we can make.
Yeah, rate of return.
Come hell or high water. And guys would pick a rate like guys and her. They'd say, okay, we're going to make 5% or 4.5% or 4%. So then you have an actuary look at your people and say, okay, how young are they? How old are they? How much are they making now? And then here's what you can expect they have to pay out over these years, you know, 20, 30 years from now, or 10 or whatever, because people are always retiring. And then you match those numbers up and you put the rate on there, and bingo, this is what Pullman has to contribute to the plan every month. I mean, it's complicated, but it's also simple. Well, for a long period of time now, all your fixed income is paying 10, 11, 12 instead of 4 or 5. So everybody's pension plan was overfunded. Now, the ERISA laws said that you cannot walk in there and say, hey, we made, you couldn't make 7% 1 year when your number was 4, and next year pull out the extra 3. Those were the government rules. But as people, as we talk about on the show all the time, in virtually every walk of life, some bleeps find a way around it. Okay, so Pullman essentially couldn't raid their own pension plan, but if you bought Pullman, you got to redo the whole thing and essentially raid the pension plan. So Pullman's takeover was not necessarily so much for Pullman. It was the extra $50, $60, $100 million that was in the pension plan that Pullman couldn't get at that the next people could, back when $50, $60, $100 million was a lot of money. So you might ask yourself, self, how the hell in 1980-something or 2000, how do these pension plans have problems, or 9/11? When you say, because they were so overfunded 15 years before or 10 years before. Well, the answer was they all got raided. I mean, there's a reason why United Airlines became UAL Inc. They revalued the pension plan. There's no way on earth, if that hadn't happened, that these plans would have been broke like Carl's talking about for pilots and people.
Well, that's right, but that's fraud. And the thing is that we don't punish.
Well, it wasn't. It was legal.
And when, I'm not saying it wasn't legal. I'm saying it's actuarially unsound. Everyone knew it was actuarially unsound. Mathematically, it's suicidal because you are presuming that your superior results this year will be repeated ad infinitum forever, and you'll never have a bad one.
Well, if you laid people off, which I was, if you laid people off, they had another trick. Kevin, I think we've talked about this. They had another little trick. They could, if there's 50 of us in the plan, of course, there would help a lot more. They could take all 50 of us and say, how much do we really owe this Tom Howell guy, this Kevin O'Neill guy? And, Tom's only 28 or 29. And by the way, he's not even really vested yet. Now, you had to vest everybody. So they called me up and they said, you have the choice of like $20 a month when you're 65 or like $200 today. I said, I'll make the bet that I'll make it to 65. But they didn't. So they actually had to buy everybody a little annuity plan based on what you were going to get, which was way less than what was in the fund. Now, if you don't lay people off, I think you can just take the money and start over. And those are the people who got hurt. They were laid off and didn't get anything. It was well known what was happening. It wasn't just they made a bad investment at Ryerson. That wasn't it at all.
Right.
It was taken. But because it was quote within the ERISA, how could you write a law that says you guys can't steal the money, but if I buy the place, I can steal it?
Because that's what we end up with when we have these 1,000-page bills that absolutely no one reads, and you have cackling Nancy telling us we have to pass it before we can see what's in it.
Yeah.
And by the way, when that was done with Obamacare, I was probably one of five people in the country who literally stayed up all night with the espresso machine going and read the entire effing thing before they voted on it.
Well, Kevin, do Indiana and Michigan, which you're very involved with, Illinois, out of all the mess goes on in Illinois, they have the one, was it one subject, one bill thing here? Do Indiana and Michigan have the same thing or not?
I don't know, but they should. I'm not a fan at all of anything. As soon as I hear the word comprehensive reform, I am just ready to run for the hills. However, I think should happen is that anybody who's going to vote in Congress, and this would have to be a rule of Congress, should probably have to sign something that says, I have read it, I understand it.
Well, you could go halfway and give them the time to read it.
That would make all the long bills go away right away.
Well, you could also meet them halfway and at least give them time to read it.
What's that?
You could meet them halfway and at least give them time to read it if they wanted to.
Well, they still wouldn't read it.
Yeah, well.
They still wouldn't read it. So, no, just you have to sign off. Yeah, I can't vote unless I've read it. Boy, wouldn't that be a refreshing change? And, boy, I'm telling you, there wouldn't be a lot of 2,000-page bills anymore. I think they'd all of a sudden get much, much smaller.
One of my proposed changes in the law is that for every 50 pages of text, you must have one business day before you can vote.
Oh, that's pretty good, too. Yeah, that's an improvement.
Now, you have other things that you have to do if you're a legislator, right? I mean, you know, your entire day can't be spent with your nose buried in a piece of paper or a computer screen. So for every 8.5 by 11 piece of double-spaced, formatted, you know, what they call conformed legislative text, you must have one business day. And this means that if you want to do something like that, guess what? You ain't voting on it for a year.
Yeah, well, didn't we had somebody on, Kevin, was he was on, where the these bills, they don't send them out, this is a while ago, they don't send them out by computer because they don't want them to get forwarded. They're actually hard copied somewhere in the bowels of Congress, and you got to go down and read them.
Well, yeah, there are lots of things where you have to, you may have to even go in a skiff and do it, and you're not allowed to take anything in or out. There's all kinds of documents that are treated like that.
Is a bill not even passed yet treated like that? Somebody was on the air and said that it was. Was it Wayne? Or somebody said?
I don't think they sequester bills like that.
No, you can't. A bill has to be available, and there is a rule that, so there's a way to waive it, It's the congressional procedure is bizarre. You know, Robert's rules generally control because it's a, you know, it's a collegial body. But as with all such things, there are, you know, you can write your own procedures, so to speak. It's one of the pieces of horse wrangling that goes on with each new Congress, is you have to have your organizational rules. That's the first thing that has to be passed. And so and that's where all the committee stuff and, you know, and all that goes on. But there are allegedly rules, but it, I think the current constraint is 3 days. But if you, you know, one of these... That can be waived, by the way, by special procedure. However, the you know the reality is that if I thought when the original TARP thing, you know, was one sheet of paper, right, and it got bounced, and then you know, oh my God, the market went down big, and so we have to pass it because otherwise the end of America is going to come, and there's going to be tanks in the streets, and it got passed. And then, of course, you know, the Obamacare thing comes out. And that's that. At the time, I thought that was an abomination with 700 pages. These last couple of omnibuses have been like 3,000 or 4,000.
Well, they're essentially budget bills, aren't they?
Yeah, but the thing is that it's not supposed to be done that way. What's supposed to happen, and what has always been the case up until this became the new normal, if you will, is that there were a set of bills. That were it was typically 13 of them that funded separate pieces of the government, and each of those went through a committee process. So there was none of this. Everything goes in one piece. They went through different committees. So the ones that dealt with defense, for example, went through Homeland Security, went through you know the DoD committees, Armed Services, and things like this. And so and all of them end up going through Ways and Means because that's. Those are the tax guys. That's the tax guys. Okay, so everything goes through Ways and Means. But all these bills had to go through the committees, the relevant committees. You know, something that dealt with energy went through the Energy Committee. Okay, you know, I mean, there was some sense to this. There was some logic to it. But you can't do that in a week or a day or whatever have you. And then the other problem with that from current congressional practices point of view is that you can't take... something, call it the Inflation Reduction Act, and essentially create a huge amount of unfunded government spending, in this case, you know, $400-500 billion of it, and throw that in there and say, oh, by the way, you know, this piece that we need in here in order to fund air traffic controllers for the FAA, if you don't pass this, there's no air traffic in the United States. Because they don't get paid.
Well, what? A couple quick questions.
By the way, right, sorry, you know, the naming conventions for bills, I think there ought to at least be the ability to for caning or put people in stocks or something for some of the names of these because it's just ridiculous. This goes back to like No Child Left Behind. If you vote against that, you want to leave children behind.
Oh, gee, Kevin, I would love to see stocks and rotten. But now here's the thing: only rotten tomatoes. Okay, we can't have actual harm done, but rotten tomatoes are fair game.
Yeah, they smell bad, but they don't hurt you.
What quick? Once in a while, you'll hear. That's not necessarily on national TV, but if you listen to the radio and interview somebody, where they might actually say some truth, somebody will ask a question about some idea or some bill, you know, whatever that seems innocuous. And whatever, like, you know, doing something with Social Security or tweaking it or something. And somebody will say, well, we are, both sides of the aisle are agreed on this. We're just waiting for a bill to attach it to. Why didn't somebody just bring it up for a vote tomorrow morning?
Because it'll fail.
Even if both sides say it's okay,
well,
they haven't tacked anything onto it yet.
Oh, that's right. And oh, by the way, both sides say it's okay. Well, if it's okay, why don't you pass it? Well, because then we can't take this thing that we know that nobody really wants and make it happen.
So you get so it's about. This is another. I don't know if you guys know the answer to this. If for instance, the three of us got elected to the House, and they go, well, we got to keep these guys quiet. And stick us on like the Armed Services Committee or the Agriculture Committee 6 months after they pass the 5-year bill so you don't do anything for 3 years. Do we have access you know, if we sniff around and say, boy, there's a huge bill going through the tax committee or something, do we have access to that or no?
Well, you do and you don't. In theory, you should, but in reality, kind of, sort of not, because, like, work product inside a committee is in the committee, okay? And so kind of no, but kind of yes. I mean, you know, think about it, Chief. The way it all used to be, you know, when the floor was still around, right? And, you know, you showed up on the floor to trade every day. You may not have known every single thing that was going on in the next pit over, but you probably went and had beers with the guys after the day was over, right? So you kind of did know, even if you didn't have the exact information, you did know because you hung out with those dudes.
So in other words, we'd have to join the softball team, go for a beer, and say, hey, what are you guys doing on your committee?
Yeah, and it's, you know, that kind of, but so that kind of informal thing is of course always going to be there because you're all part of the same club, so to speak. But there is some argument for the, you know, the separation of, you know, of work products simply because the total amount of work product is so large. But committee assignments are a big deal, and this is one of the ways that they punish people within the party hierarchy that do things they don't like. You won't get anything. So you're a congressperson, but you have no committees.
What if question for both of you guys, then maybe we'll go to a quick break here, but what if, and I'm going to say it's not going to happen, what if the three of us put together a third party and instead of running for the presidency the first time, we decided to run 25 people for the House, you know, real good people in districts where it's somewhat split, and you know, the people ended up, they're people that were known, I mean, that did some stuff and not just shot off their mouth, and 20 of the 25 win, and they all of a sudden their fannies are in Congress. What would they do? Would they be banned of all committees? Would they be, if the House was tight enough, you'd need their votes for one group to take charge, right? So you'd have some leverage there. But what if you didn't? They could just X you out of everything for 2 years.
Well, yeah, pretty much. But do remember that the House typically, at least in certain areas, is tight enough. So this was, you know, this was how the Speaker got bounced, right? Was that they couldn't lose those half dozen Congress people who were bent out of shape enough about it to actually do something. All right. So there's, most of the time, even when the balance is fairly lopsided, it's not that lopsided. I mean, if you can get 20 Congress people together, do you have something? All right. Now, of course, the problem is that the party machinery can try to do things that will screw you as a group. Okay. So this is one of the things that's been kind of interesting about this whole squad thing that, you know, that kind of showed up when AOC came into office along with a couple of others. And that it survived as long as it did without being, you know, picked apart by the vultures, as, you know, as is now happening. That was a little surprising to me, especially because of some of the relatively extreme positions that were taken that even within the Democrat caucus were over the top.
Kevin, how long did the Tea Party last? Like two, three sessions? How many?
About 2 years.
That's about it.
About 2 years, and I was one of the people that was in the middle of. I never had any power with it, but I was one of the very loud advocates for it. And then when that got corrupted almost instantly, and got turned into the guns, gays, and God party, part of the Republicans. And as soon as it did, I disavowed it. I wrote a big article on it. I blasted it publicly. And went scorched earth on them because the entire premise of it would turned out to be a. Now I don't know if it was originally a lie, or if it got co-opted, but that
I'm pretty sure it got co-opted.
Yeah, but that the establishment saw that as truly dangerous and had to be destroyed, and they did.
Well, you also have a.
I think the the closest thing to a remnant of it is the Freedom Caucus, and you know, while that has its fair amount of representation, I don't see them swinging a big club.
No, and that's, you know, that's essentially the problem, is that you have, when you allow the boundaries of the Constitution, which set forth a quite limited federal government in terms of its powers, when you allow that to be trampled on for, you know, 200 years, to the point that it's a joke, right, and you allow outright frauds to go unanswered, is just one of many examples. All of the firearms regulation at the federal level came out of Miller, which was a fairly early case having to do with a sawed-off shotgun. And Miller was prosecuted for having, and the rubric of this was that such a weapon was unsuitable for infantry use. Now, remember what we hear today, right? Yeah. You cannot have an AR-15 because it's a weapon of war, okay? Well, the case went to the Supreme Court on the exact inverse of that argument, that sawed-off shotguns were not infantry weapons, and therefore there was no right to possess them under the Second Amendment. It was the argument from the government was a knowing lie. It went to trial after World War I. The government had ordered thousands of sawed-off shotguns for production use during the war in World War I to clear trenches, because in a trench, obviously, you have very little room, right? Swinging a big gun around is a problem. So, sawed-off shotguns. By the time the case got to the Supreme Court, Miller had been bankrupt, so he had no representation there. The holding from the Supremes was that he did not have a right to possess the gun, and therefore he was, you know, it was affirmed. But the reason it was found that way was that the government literally lied directly to the Supreme Court. Now, this was later proved because, of course, the decision comes out and then people are like, hey, wait a minute, here's the invoices for all these cases of sawed-off shotguns that you used 10 years earlier. What are you talking about?
Just remember, Major League Baseball is not interstate commerce.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that everything flowed from that, okay? So all of these, if we ever had an actual Supreme Court, if we ever had an actual Congress, if we ever had an actual Department of Justice and a real law enforcement agency, any time that somebody went and did something of that kind within the government, they'd go to prison.
We have all that stuff for some people, just not for others.
Well, some people go to prison. Yeah, you go, you know. But then again, you know, we just got done being told a few days ago by Governor Polis out in Colorado that there are no Venezuelan gangs taking over apartment buildings.
Yeah, right. Well,
Sure there aren't. That's
well,
why
there's always going to be a few. Hey, before we lose Kevin, any big games this weekend, Kevin? We got Texas Michigan. That's the headliner, right?
I think Texas Michigan is the big headline game. Yeah, that's. I'm looking forward. Actually, I'm going to go over to campus tomorrow and tailgate for a while, but I'm going to try and get back at least for the second half of that
Didn't Joel say it starts at noon?
What's that?
Didn't Joel say it starts at noon?
Yeah, it's an early game.
Well, I'm saying how are you going to?
So I'll be over at campus at about, I don't know, 10:30, something like that.
And do you have a parking pass? Are you just going to park?
No, I'll park off campus. I've got some friends who are, having a tailgate, so I'm going to go visit them.
You're going to go freeload?
Pardon?
You're going to go freeload?
I'll take a few mini margaritas in my pockets.
There you go. Norton?
Well, I mean, I got my tailgating tastes.
Well, I'm going to get no end of heat about playing Mighty Northern Illinois tomorrow. But do you believe last week the teams, the big teams that played these crummy teams, and it was like 70-0?
Almost every one of them. So yeah. When everybody gives you a hard time, almost every one of them will play a lower division team, and particularly the SEC teams have a big habit of not playing them early in the season as a practice game, but as playing them right before their big rivalry games late in the season, so that they have a cupcake leading up to it and can just.
Well, not now that people
dress rehearsal.
But now that people are paying people, I think the disparity between last week, weren't there like three or four games that were in the 60s to the zeros or something?
Yeah, and there always are. That happens every year. I do a, you know, just a little somewhat tongue-in-cheek write-up and back and forth with a friend of mine on IndyNation.com, and we give out what we call the Pinkle Award every week. It is for the most egregious mismatch, named after the former Missouri coach who used to complain about other teams doing it when he did it, too.
I know you guys always give me no end of grief deserved about my constantly looking at the numbers, but I think it has to get worse. What do you suppose today, I use the term payroll, the difference in the payroll between the Irish team and Northern Illinois is? 100 to 1?
No, it's substantial. But the talent differential has always been substantial. So
what I'm saying, with the payroll, do you think Northern Illinois is paying anybody?
Yes, of course they are. Not much, but yeah, I'm sure they have their booster groups.
Mm-hmm.
Northern Illinois has had its, you know, occasional uprising. They're in the Mid America Conference, which isn't a bad conference. I think, you know, people see directional school name and think the worst, but actually, if it were Ohio University, or actually Notre Dame is playing Miami of Ohio. In a few weeks, but I think if people were to see Ohio University or Bowling Green, they'd think, well, not so bad. But they see Northern Illinois and say, oh, directional school.
Yeah. Well, they're out of all those schools,
they've Eastern or Western Illinois.
But out of that whole group, they've been the standout best team. I mean, they've been to bowls a few times, right?
But they even made it to the Orange Bowl one year.
Yeah.
When they're not. So yeah, they've had a pretty good program over the years.
I just wonder.
They get a lot of Chicago area kids. You know, they get the guys that don't go to the Big Ten, but they get good football players.
As this continues to consolidate into the 40 teams that are essentially pros versus the other, I almost wonder if you shouldn't say, you 40 only play each other. You don't get to beat up on the other guys.
Well, I think that day will come. I absolutely believe it will come, especially when you're making conferences with 20 teams in them. You know, how are you going to have any kind of a conference race? You know, it's going to suck up all the
oxygen,
all the available games.
I mean, I don't think Major League Baseball would let the Cubs or the Sox play the Gary Railcats just for an extra date at home. Maybe they would. I don't know.
And yet, that's what's happening in college football. Yeah,
it's kind of what's happening. Well, Kevin, thanks, buddy. So what time is our game tomorrow? It's a afternoon.
3:30. It's 3:30 game.
All right. So you get a chance to get over and. You have a couple and get back for them. But I'm surprised that game's 12 o'clock, Michigan, Texas, aren't you?
Well, I forget which network has it, but the Big Ten has so many teams and plenty of good games, you know, big-name teams on there, that they can pretty much line up the whole damn day.
No,
and when we say 12 o'clock, I believe that's 11 Central, so, you know, pay attention.
Well, this is for another show, but what do you suppose the difference in advertising / viewership of that game at noon versus 7 o'clock?
Well, primetime game would probably do a little better, you know, but it sort of depends on who watches those games, and I don't know the demographic of it. Texas has a lot of hardcore fans, so Texas people will watch the game if you put it on at 8 o'clock in the morning. And Michigan is the same way.
Yeah,
so you're going to get a good audience. You're going to get a better audience there than you'll ever get in the in that same time slot with most other teams.
Well, you put the Irish Southern Cal at it for
them. At it on margin, and then they say, "Well, we got a pretty good primetime matchup we can show too."
Yeah, I'm going to say if the Irish played Southern Cal at 9 a.m, we'd all watch it.
Yeah, we absolutely would. Let me take a quick look before I sign off. Let me take a quick look and see. What that schedule looks like, because let's see, we want the
there are a couple other good games tomorrow, I think.
Yeah, there's always a few, even before the season starts, there's always a few. So Texas and Michigan are on Fox has games all day. I'm sure I'd love this, you know, if I could get a quick sort on that would be interesting. Fox has Baylor and Utah at 3:30. That's actually a pretty good game, even though most of us don't follow either team very closely. And then Fox probably has a good night game somewhere on here. As I look at it, not seeing it at a glance. So I won't keep you. Go ahead, take a break, because we are closing in on the jobs report.
Yeah, we're 15 minutes away
as it rolls out.
What
those numbers are coming.
What if
by
any?
By the way, ISM was bad for manufacturing again this year, this month. Services did spike up a little bit, and of course that one consistently strong sector, the hospital report, looks great.
Of course.
Yeah, I don't think that's where we want the economy to thrive.
Well, you certainly, you'd like to have that available if you get in a car accident or you get shot, right? I mean, that's kind of, yeah. On the other hand, don't do it at Sacred Heart down in my old place of residence in Destin, because apparently the surgeons down there do not know the difference between a liver and a spleen.
Well, that's the difference.
Yeah. Just take them both. Yeah. If you're not sure, grab both.
By the way, the guy died.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising. Which one they took out the
took
liver?
Took the liver out.
That's not good.
You're done when that happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, what if any influence does the adjustment 2 weeks ago that everybody was all up in arms about have to do with today's numbers? None?
Not really much. And the other thing about that adjustment is that, as I've noted, it always seems to go one direction. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Random errors, of course, are normally distributed. Anybody that's ever had a stats class knows this. So, no, that's not a random error. It doesn't have to be intentional. You know, of course, there are plenty of people all over the internet that are screaming that, this is because they're trying to help the Biden administration. A bias doesn't have to have intent. But it's still bias. And if you are getting a consistently biased result, whether it's intentional or not, if you're an honest statistician, you have a duty to figure out why it's happening and fix it. The problem, of course, is that the Bureau of Lies and Scams never bothers with that.
Right, if we forget for a second that maybe it's done, I won't say intentionally, but the winds are blowing from Vichy or something, and I'm rolling with Vichy. How essentially could it happen? We have our list. Somebody somewhere gives us our list of establishments. It's called the establishment survey, right? So,
correct.
So theoretically, somebody is surveying establishments, right? So we got our list
we actually got called one time when I was running my company.
Okay, so I mean, I don't think that's ever going to happen here, but somebody's getting called. All right, so here's a list of, let's say, 25 people. We're calling the Ford plant in Torrance Avenue or something. How many guys you got? Well, we've got 4,000 or 3,000. How many did you have last month? We had 2,900. Okay, so looks like you're up 100. All right, so whatever it is, somebody tabulates this up, and if they do it, if you got your adding machine works, you're going to get this number. Countrywide, it's, based on their survey, it looks like it's 200,000 or something like that. Well, for how does that get revised? The guy at the Ford plant calls me back up and says, "Hey, remember I said we're up 100 people? I screwed up. We're actually down 100 people." And how would you ever get the second phone call, I guess, or the second piece of paper, Carl, to where there would actually even be a revision?
Well, so as with most samples, it's not, you don't get all the data at once, and some of it is done by mail. So you have a cutoff. You have the sample week when this data is allegedly collected, but you don't have all of it. Same thing that happens with GDP. Right? You have a GDP advanced survey, but all the data hasn't come back yet at the time you report it. So then, a month later, now you got it all, right? So at that point, all of these reports are retrospective, but not all the data is in. So some of that, that kind of revision is fine. The problem is that when it goes on for months and months, like it did here, right, and then it's always in one direction. And, we see this every month. We have, we're going to get the August numbers here in a few minutes, and then they'll revise the July number, right? Well, how come the revisions only go one way? If there's a sampling problem in your data, then you solve the sampling problem. But you have that, and then you have that black box birth death thing that they play with all the time, which is only on the establishment side, and it's one of the reasons I don't use the establishment survey in trying to formulate anything.
Well, what's your feel on? We went through this guy when we first started the show, Carl. We were economy was slipping pretty bad, and I was saying, you know, they actually, this was one of the, this before the COVID year, or some other year, I forget what the other one was, probably like 10, 12 years ago, where the people, you could just tell the economy by the numbers and just by observation, economy was going downhill a little bit, not up, and yet the people from the, you know, birth-death thing came out that year and said all these new businesses were created, and you're sitting there going, where did that come from? What is their basis of, I mean, you're not going to know the person is there until you get the 1099. You're probably not going to call the Carl Chief house company that is now putting up 10 houses where 2 months ago we weren't even in business. I mean, there is a reason for these estimates, but it would seem to me a pretty tough game to try and figure out. I mean, my conclusion always has been that when the economy's going good, it's actually going better than you think, and when it's going lousy, it's going lousier than you think, because you're not going to catch that either way, right?
Right, and one of the biggest issues that comes up is when you have turns, okay, which, you know, I would argue that we're kind of in the middle of that now.
Right? I'm right with you.
All right, I mean, there's a, and the internals in that data have, there's been things that, you know, that I've noted for quite a while. I don't like the trend lines that are in a number of areas that nobody talks about. Nobody in the major, you know, the major media and the CNBC group and stuff wants to have any kind of conversation about this all. They never will. And one of the big issues is that, you know, people talk about this great replacement theory, and, you know, everybody wants to have a conspiracy of some kind behind something, right? That all these people are out here with the intent of screwing you. My simpler explanation, and this is what I get for, you know, for listening too much Friedman when I was younger, is that everybody acts in, first and foremost, in economic interest within business. They all do. I don't care who you are. That's what you do. Why? Because that's your duty. That's your first duty, is make money.
Well, you got to be able to pay people.
Well, I'm just saying, yeah. Nobody goes into business to lose money, right? I mean, no one. So, and being, having been one of those guys that many times when I was getting going, but, you know, made payroll 3 p.m. on Friday.
Right? Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, been there, done that. I know exactly how this works. And so the idea that you are not going to seek those advantages is lunacy. And the people in the political sphere that think that there's, you know, some that's complete nonsense. It's garbage. It has always been garbage. The thing is, we have laws and regulations because left unbridled, the common person always gets hosed by this. Always. And that's the reason that there are rules of the game. And it's, you know, it's the same thing in football. If you don't have, you know, why can't I hit the guy with my helmet in the neck?
Yeah.
Right? Well, because that's considered unsportsmanlike, because it's likely to injure or kill him. That's why. Well, you know, some of us, I mean, I would say, well, you know, hey, one of the answers to that is take the helmet off, right? Now the risk is equal on both sides. But, of course, you know, that's not what we do.
No.
Right, but there is, you have these rules in business as well. They're not enforced at all.
They're selectively enforced, which makes it even worse.
Yeah, it's even worse. I mean, as I pointed out, Chief, you find for me, now 15 U.S.C. Chapter 1 has been in the books for over 100 years, okay, was passed due to what at the time was perceived to be a real issue with monopolization. And the whole, yeah, I mean, this came out of Standard Oil, but it wasn't exclusively Standard Oil. It was a bunch of other companies that were doing the same sort of thing. Law's been on the books for over 100 years. It is not just a civil offense. It is a criminal felony. You do 10 years in prison for violating it. 8 U.S.C. 1324 has been on the books since the 1950s, was passed due to issues with illegal immigration at the time, and the offshoot that came from the New Deal and the Great Society programs, which essentially gave you a welfare right to access public funds without having to do any work in exchange for it. So, okay. So the people said, hey, wait a minute, there's a problem with this, and that anybody can show up and just drain the treasury without having to make any kind of contribution back to society. So you passed 8 U.S.C. 1324, which says if you aid, abet, or otherwise, you know, employ, give housing to anything, an illegal immigrant, it's 10 years in the slammer. It's not a fine.
Well, if we did that 25 years ago, every single rich person who belonged to a country club would have been in jail.
Well, okay, but here's the thing. So, and by the way, the law goes on to say that if you do this and that illegal alien kills an American, it's a life sentence.
Well,
it's not 10 years in prison. It's bye-bye. Now, we have had, under both of the last administrations, we've had two very public cases where exactly that happened. Okay? Molly Tibbetts when Trump was president, and then Lincoln Riley during the current administration. Neither one of the people, and by the way, the guy who was housing and employing the convicted killer of Molly Tibbetts, so it's not an accusation, he actually was convicted of the crime, that person is not in prison. He owned a farm, and he was a very influential GOP person in his area.
Yeah, well.
Well, you know, and so he did not pay any penalty whatsoever under the law that has been on the books for 50 years. But if you enforced just a few of, if you did this just enough times for people to be convinced that it wasn't political targeting, which of course would be...
Well, which you did a few times, it would be political targeting.
Well, when you first started, everyone would assume it is, right?
Right,
and it probably
you,
would be.
But I mean, the only issue I have with this, and I can't believe I'm going to say something stupid like this, but it's sort of like policemen shooting people here in Chicago. Okay, we've had 2,132 shootings in the city this year, and I'm thinking like four of them were policemen. Now, it doesn't excuse right. the four, but for God's sake, I mean, we've got...
How about all the rest? Right.
Yeah, I mean, so it's the same thing with... If one of the migrants here in Chicago, and I haven't seen anything here with these guys doing this kind of stuff, but if somebody went out and blasted somebody, it'd be 2,133. It'd be really hard for me to pick that group out as the shooters around here.
Well,
but it doesn't excuse the one. I'm not saying it does.
No, all I'm saying, Chief, is that virtually every serious issue that we have from a budgetary perspective, from a, you know, you look at the cost of housing, what would happen if we got rid of 20 million illegal aliens in the United States? The cost of housing would crash, okay? There would be a bunch of other things that would crash along with it. Maybe this would be good, maybe it would be bad. Certainly there would be people that would get hosed economically on all sides. However, if we enforce the anti-monopoly statutes, health care would be one-fifth of the price. By the way, selling a drug in America for $1,000 a month, Ozempic, Wegovy, whatever, while it's $50 in Germany, is a per se violation of that statute.
It's not a
fine. These people are supposed to go to prison.
You and I are absolute the right and you know, this idea of selective prosecution or no prosecution of the patent laws and any sort of a...
Tell me how I dealt with some of this when I was running my internet company, in that we had large monopolist firms that we had to deal with.
Yeah.
In order, because they provided essential services, like, for example, dedicated circuits going from one place to another, right?
Try to do a bid anywhere 15 years ago where the server you had to use wasn't IBM.
Exactly. But this is the problem. When you don't enforce that, what happens to everybody who's trying to compete in that
market? They're screwed, and that's why there's a difference in stock price between the have-nots and the haves. SP futures down 26. We're going to go a little earlier, Carl, so you can actually get a chance to look at these while I stumble along with the big numbers, and you tell me I'm all wrong like we do every month. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains. Think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Good morning.
Give us a call about your stock. 888-76-JACKS. That's 888-765-6257. Or email us stocksandjacks@live.com. Hello, North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Hobrick, and aboard SP Futures flopping around, but we're down 20. It's really moving. SP or Nasdaq Futures down 143. The number came in at 142 versus 161 estimated. Who are these estimators, as Mayor Daley would say? And we've got the unemployment rate is at 4.2.
That's down a tick.
Yeah, that's down a tick. I've got...
I got trouble inside this report though. The unadjusted households down 690. That's a bad number.
The adjusted's up 2. That's a big adjustment.
That's the first negative since January, which is usually a firing month. Okay. That's it. In fact, that is not a good number. -690 is not a good number. And the couch surfer number is up plus 1.171 million.
Right, this thing's got it up 100,000.
Yeah, well...
These adjustments are huge, or is it just me? They're bigger than normal, aren't they?
The month over month, the 12-month unemployed... This is maybe the most important element within it. The 12-month delta unemployed is actually negative now. Now, right. It hasn't been for a very long time coming out of the pandemic, right? I mean, it's been, you know, wildly positive all the way back to, you know, 2021-03 was the last 12-month neg number. And then, of course, it was huge. It was plus 17 million the month after that on a 12-month rolling basis. Because that's of course when we started to come back out of the, you know, everybody go home and sit on your butts. But yeah, this month the 12-month rolling rate is -79, which is this deterioration's been going on for a while now. It's not a new thing. This started to more or less come apart about 15-16 months ago. And the concern that I have had overall, Chief, has been that when you look at the non-institutional population, you know, it's like I was talking about on the show a while ago, we've gone from a 2.2% expansion rate annualized back in 2000, and now we're at a 0.55. So that's a you know, 75% decrease, right? Since it takes 17 years from the time that you decide to have a child in order for them to show up in the non-institutional working population, because that's 16 plus, this means that at the present trend rates, assuming that they're actually real, that will go negative. And when it does, then all of your arguments about expanding demand within housing, within all these other sectors, they're all going to go down the toilet immediately.
For the on the A1 number here, which is the unadjusted, I'm guessing, Carl, and this will be really interesting, if the unadjusted doesn't match up the adjusted on a yearly basis. But this is exactly what I think. I'll try and do these numbers simply as best they can. The people available to work are up 700,000, roughly, 167.8 to 168.5.
Right.
It's pretty close to what you have. Now, even though the establishment survey tells us every month people are, even this month, in a crummy month, there's 142,000 new jobs. Now, again, those guys count, if you work twice, two jobs, they count it. Household survey does not. Now, right. Of the 168,549, remember, 700,000 up in people available, I've actually got 50,000 less working, so less, not the 200,000 or 225 a month they're telling us in the establishment survey. So if you call up and just say people that are actually working, there's less than last year. Now, from that, 800,000 is gone up in the unemployed, and roughly 80,000, sorry, are in the unemployed, and 800,000 the unemployed, and a million in the couch surfers. So the million people that we have entering the workforce, they're basically gone into either unemployed or couch surfers, and they're not working.
Right.
Right. Because right. The unemployment rate's up from 3.8 to 4.2. That's a lot. And the amount of people, the percentage of the people working went from 60.4 down to 60, and that's the number that I just have. If that number goes to 52 or 55, there's no way I know if you balance any budget anywhere, Carl.
Well, yeah, and this is the biggest issue that you have with all of this is the employment population ratio, okay, which I have long yelled about all the way back to when I first started tracking this stuff. You know, we were, if you go back to like right around 2000, just before the tech wreck, this number was bouncing around in the 63.5 to 64 area. Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's historically where it's been. Well, if you go take a look at this back into the time of the housing crash, which started in earnest in middle of 08 and through 09, right? I mean, you know, Lehman was September. Of course, the rumblings were earlier, but Lehman was September. And the economic impact really got serious right around the end of the year. That, by the time we got into the first month of 09, that number was at 59.8. Okay, now we've never seen prints materially over 60 again. Even in this so-called recovery, we've never broke 61. And the crash.
I got it. 60.4 is the highest.
Yeah, I mean, I've got it. Yeah. Well, I've got a 60.7, but again, this is unadjusted, and that was off at July of last year. But we've never broken 61, and now we're trending. We're drifting in the downward direction again.
So people in 2007, these numbers were 63. That's a boatload of people, 60 to 63.
Every tick is 600,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive.
It's enormous. And the thing is, only the people that are on the in that 60% as it is today, those are the only people that pay taxes when you get down to it.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, you don't pay taxes.
Well, not really. If you're retired, you're still paying all the other taxes.
Well, I get that. But I mean, when you get down to it, who's funding in the individual income tax and the contribution taxes from FICA, Medicare? those taxes are coming from people who are working.
Right.
In one way. Now, yes, there is, you know, you are paying income tax on, you know, on gains, on cap gains, at a lower rate. You're paying income tax on dividends and, you know, and depending on the type of dividends, those might be taxed at your cap
gain. Well, you're zeroing on the income tax, but you're right. You don't pay any payroll taxes if you're retired.
You're paying all kinds of other taxes. You're paying sales tax. You're paying property tax.
But there's no Medicare or there's no employment tax on that kind of stuff, on dividends
right. And the thing is, employment taxes are in many ways some of the most important from a standpoint of fiscal stability because they come from the first dollar. Okay, you pay FICA tax on the first dollar of wages. There is none of this, well, you know, we're going to be politically nice to you, and so if you make less than 15 grand, you don't pay any income tax. Okay, that's true. However, you still pay FICA. Okay? And you pay all of both halves, because if you didn't pay it, your boss would have to pay you. So, I mean, that goes into the cost of having you on staff. People think, oh, no, my employer pays it. That's BS. If you didn't have a job, it wouldn't get paid. So this is that number, that as of today, 60.0, according to this, is one of the key fiscal stability indicators. And if you take a look at the explosion in the deficits and national debt, you find a huge part of what's driven that exponential increase right there.
Well, and you have so, just a real quick, because you're going through it kind of quick. Your income tax revenue is $2.3 billion. Your payroll tax is $1.6. I mean, it's almost the same.
Not a small number.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a small number. People are like, oh, that's not all that big of a deal because it's only, you know, 50%. Uh-huh. Okay. By the way, since that's assessed from the first dollar and there are no there is one deduction against it, which is if you're self-employed, there's a small amount that's exempt before you get hit on it. But not much.
I don't know about that.
Well, no, there is. It's
how much?
You know, it gets into the, chief. It's not very much. Okay.
I think if you pay somebody $100 to cut your lawn, I think the guy owes 15.
Well, he does, except at the end of the year, there is, I've been paying this for a very long time because I mean, all my work since I sold the company has not been W-2. It's all 1099 stuff. But there is a small amount that does get bounced back. But I'll tell you, you know, my daughter, she's essentially, I mean, she's worked W-2 jobs, but she's been working 1099 jobs for quite a while. You want to hear the four-letter words come out of her mouth when we have to do her taxes.
Oh, yeah.
Because she has to, you know, she used to see that on her pay stubs in her when she got her W-2s. And she'd be like, well, wait a minute, where'd all that go? I said, well, guess what? That surprise, no matter, you don't pay much in the way of income tax, but you sure pay this. And now she has to actually remit it herself. It doesn't get withheld. She has to pay both halves, of course. And she's not real happy about that. Neither is anybody else that does it. I've been doing it for long enough that it's like, yeah, okay, I know what the deal is on this. But you'd be surprised how many people that have regular jobs that think that, oh, you know, that's not real. Well, of course it's real. Go work for yourself and you'll find out all about it.
Well, I mean, if you think for a second that people don't, I mean, if you give somebody some money and they own a house, between their property taxes, between their and if you own a car, God love you, in terms right. of tax. I mean, the idea that once in a while you see, you know, one of the jamokes on CNBC say something like, well, you know, you got to get a flat tax because other people don't participate. Look at how many people don't pay taxes. Yeah, they do. We just have a four-legged tax stool.
Right.
And
another interesting thing. Since, you know, we're talking, I can, you know, scroll through this thing. This is the first month in quite some time that the employment population ratio in all the educational fields did not have some group, one of the four subgroups, with a negative print. Now that's interesting. They're either all positive or flat. Now that's a dislocation based on what you see in the unadjusted household. Because the unadjusted households neg 690. So how are you neg 690 if nobody lost ground in that other table? That doesn't make sense.
No. Hey, we mentioned earlier when Kevin was in regarding the medical sort of thing. Now, it is stunning, and I don't know how to capsulize, to actually put a number on this, but observation has me with a number that I'm almost shuddering. And out, everybody knows Audrey and Nancy are all in Tinley Park area. If you drive around, we have four or five now pretty much major medical groups here in the Chicago area, right, that are becoming pretty much a cartel. Without a doubt. And if you look at four or five new buildings out there that are gorgeous and are huge.
Guess whose they are.
It's
right.
All theirs. I mean, Loyola has this huge thing. Silver Cross has one. Northwestern now has one. University of Chicago. These are 10, 12-story buildings with the urgent care downstairs or something. Doctors in that area. I mean, the doctors, nobody's an independent doctor anymore. Not very many people.
Right.
And is that all the... It's got to be 80% of the major building construction in Orland in the last 5 years.
Yeah, and guess what? Only 1 in 10 to 1 in 20 of those are doctors or nurses.
Right.
All the rest of them are engaged in screwing you out of the money.
Well, actually, those places are they're a breath of fresh air compared to an emergency room.
Oh, I'm not. Yeah. I'm not saying there aren't doctors in there, because there are. Okay.
But if you actually bang your head or have a cut to not go there and go to the emergency room, you're kind of crazy. I mean, there's people.
Well,
in there.
I'm not arguing that. Yeah. I'm simply saying that from an overhead perspective, it's outrageous, and in no competitive market would that ever survive for more than an hour. All right, because somebody would come in there and say, "Hey, guess what? I'm going to do this, but 9 out of the 10 of you are fired."
Yeah.
And the doctors and the nurses are the ones that are going to actually be employed. And you know, oh, by the way, the price is a fifth of what it is now here, or you can pay five times as much and go over there. And the game would be over. But, that's the difference between a competitive market and a cartel, is that in a cartel, that doesn't happen, right? Well, the fact that that happens, it's like, as I've pointed out, with all the subscription model stuff that we have today, basically everything, all kinds of software services, whatever have you. Unless the subscription is cheaper than ownership, if it's cheaper than ownership, then from an economic model perspective, it makes some sense. But if it's not, it is proof that there is an unlawful act going on in restraint of trade, because it is always cheaper to lease something all in terms of the quality of what you get, then you're always better off buying it if you're going to use it for any great length of time. Now, if you're not, then it isn't. But, this is the difference between leasing a car and buying a car, right? If you're going to have a car for 2 or 3 years, well, leasing it maybe makes some sense.
Well, careful with that. You can't be spewing, it's the wrong term, real economic theory in today's world, Colonel.
Because somebody is cheating somewhere.
Yeah, somebody's cheating
somewhere. Well, guess what? The fact that you're cheating somewhere means... The very fact that you're cheating means there's a problem, right? So, but here's another interesting thing. So this is in this data, okay? And this is from the household data. Now, I'm in trouble believing this. This is table A16. Would you believe that only 5.1% of employed people have multiple jobs?
No, I don't believe that at all.
Well, neither would I, but that's what the data says.
Well, some of the other jobs are helping the brother-in-law paint on a Saturday or something, you're getting cash money.
Supposedly, this is not a material percentage of the total workforce.
Well, the only way, and I've learned this from you, the only way the household number is, if you forget the alleged game playing with the revisions, the only way those numbers and the household numbers can both be relatively accurate is by saying
multiple job holders.
Two million people got a second job in the last year.
Well, and that's because the employer doesn't know, and therefore he can't report it,
right.
And the household does, and therefore they can.
Well, if you listen on Monday when Nancy comes on, who actually does a deeper dive into people's finances than anybody else gets to do, because she does.
No, I wonder why.
Yeah, well, she does. But she does their more. She goes a lot of. She would say that it's almost 2.3 jobs per family now. Yeah. Somebody's doing something. They're doing tax returns, or they're you know, whatever. They're doing an Uber on a Saturday. They're doing something, because even the two incomes don't cut it.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. And here's the other thing that's interesting. The average weekly hours across the entire economy supposedly ticked up one tick in last month. Now, I'm just telling you what it says. I'm not saying I necessarily believe it. However, it's all on the good side. The service providing is flat. And in leisure and hospitality, it's down a tick. Now, that, of course, is, you know, that's money you don't have to spend. That's, you know, going to the bar.
Well, my my nephew, who's in the steel, what do you call it? People that do specialty stuff for people. If you need a conveyor belt, they'll do the conveyor belt. If you need a part from a machine, a broken machine's 50 years old, they'll make the part. The steel fabricator, whatever you want to call it, they do the... The ones with computers, where you can program them to actually do the regular part.
Yeah, the CAD CAM stuff, yeah.
Or they'll do, you know, if you need five parts, the guy will do it on a lathe, that kind of thing.
Right.
He tells me that the huge bulge they got after COVID, and they supply, you know, there's still a few big real names in Chicago. I mean, Tootsie Roll has their only factory here in Chicago.
Sure.
And, you know, Carol, he said, if ever you can get in there, you and I would love it. He goes... It is on. They do. They say 1.5 million pieces of candy a day. There's only one factory worldwide. Because the machines that put the Tootsie Pops together, where the stick, the Tootsie Roll, the hard stuff, and the wrapper, all kind of. He goes, it's genius. It's unreal. Anyway.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, they had, because of the COVID stuff, there was a huge bulge of, hey, I got four parts broken this year because last year we didn't do as much.
Right.
Now, that seems to have subsided, and they're back down to just being pretty steady, and they still could use another couple of people, because there's not a whole lot of people trained, and all these guys that are your machinery mechanics and stuff, a lot of those guys are retiring. I mean, that whole industry needs, you know, because Chicago's just nothing but gone downhill metalworking for, you know, in my whole lifetime, and Pullman, everybody else.
Well, there's another problem with that, which is that we've become so dependent in so many areas of the economy on the whole computerization of things, that the number of people, I mean, you know, you can give me the dimensions of something in a lathe and a mill, and I can make it for you. Okay? I know how to use those machines. The number of younger people who you could put them in front of a metal lathe and say, you know, give me a rod that has this boss here for an O-ring of, you know, this diameter. Yeah, good luck, right? And yet, this is the kind of thing that is when equipment goes out of production, and it does, just, you know, companies go under, some older line gets...
What's the outfit in Cincinnati? Cincinnati... Metal, they've made the best lathes, and they last like, what, 200 years or something?
Bridgeports, you're talking about?
Well, I mean, just regular old metal lathes and big, you know, the stuff that people would work on and make the
Bridgeport
individual.
Bridgeport mills and stuff like this. Yeah, I mean, there is an art to that sort of thing. And the people that are capable of doing it, most of them have gray hair like myself. And when they're gone and they're out of the workforce and they're not doing it anymore, you need something like that. Oh boy, if you ain't got a drawing that goes into a CAD/CAM machine and you know, can have a, you know, have a computer operated mill make it for you, good luck.
Well, they used to call it at Pullman the blacksmith's job. Just show the guy the part, and he comes back 2 hours later with a part.
And he comes, he comes back and he makes it. But the thing is that we've got an awful lot of stuff in this country that. The manufacturer's long gone. There are no spares. Okay? I mean, the amount of stuff that gets scrapped. During the COVID stuff, I had to cobble together a bearing for a wheel on my lawnmower. Okay? I mean, we're talking about a literal $10 part. All right?
but it was seized. So you can't cut the grass without that, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, what is the modern answer to this? Go down to the store and buy it on a lawnmower.
Without a doubt.
Well, wait a minute. It's a $10 part. Yeah. I'm going to go spend $500 on a brand new lawnmower. There's nothing wrong with the engine. There's nothing wrong with the blade. There's nothing wrong with the deck, the handle, the cables, all the
other stuff. If you get the same lawnmower, which you probably can't, keep the old one, because when a part goes in a new one, you yank it off the old one.
Well, no, but they're not the same.
No, they're not the same.
So there's no interchangeability. Finally, I solved the problem temporarily, and then, I was able to eventually source the bearing that I needed. But this kind of thing is real, and one of the things that makes me insane with modern stuff is, modern cars, for example, every single thing goes through that effing screen in the center.
Oh yeah, see me in one of those ever.
Well, you know what? If that fails, not only can you not listen to the radio, you can't change the temperature of the vehicle. You can't adjust the air conditioner.
No. Well, when you mention people being, Chicago obviously has lost some very major manufacturing companies in the last 30, 40 years. But I used to go up to a Green Lake in Wisconsin, and one of the guys had this incredible metalworking facility. And he said, we lost all the stuff. Everybody's going to buy their machines now from Korea.
Right.
And he goes, you would think that, this is really bad. He goes, but you know what? Plus, you could eat off the floor in this guy's shop, and it was really something. He said, you know what? Those things break. You're not going to get part. You're not going to get the part from Korea. He goes, I do more business now fixing the stuff from overseas. He goes, we're happier than a clam at high tide, right? Or low tide, or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah. But this is the problem that, that so many people fail to appreciate, and this is one of the things that push economics causes when you have cartels. Go try to find a car that doesn't have that problem today. You can't.
Right, you can't.
Okay? Why not? Because somebody should be making one. I mean, you'd think if Ford or GM or Stellantis or, whoever, one of these guys, or Toyota for that matter, would turn around and say, you know what? There is a segment of the market that would buy this.
Well, Dodge just stopped production, or is going to, of their older style regular pickup, right?
Right.
And they're going to lay off all those people there's nothing wrong with the new pickups. You like all the gadgets and stuff. But I was getting my truck washed last Sunday, and of course, imagine me talking to somebody, Carl, and he's got a Dodge pick me up, and I've got my GMC, and of course, we're talking trucks, We're both not really jealous, but this guy's got this. Get a load of this. You could use one of these for pulling your thingy, your mobile home. And the guy's got a Dodge 350.
A monster.
With the full cab, front and back seat, and the 8-foot bed. Looking at this thing going, plus what it had to be like 8 inches taller than mine. No way I was getting in the garage.
I was going to say, it's 24 feet long, and I can't get it in the garage.
Yeah. Of course, the dude is from Montana, so maybe he needs it out there. But I'm looking at this thing, I'm going, wow. But the guy starts telling me, he goes, you can't buy a regular cab pickup from Dodge. You're crazy. That can't be right. He goes, no, you won't be able to get the regular cab with the 8-foot bed. He goes, which everybody in a farm and everybody in construction uses.
Right. Well, because it's not 8 feet longer than the, so the problem is if you actually want to be able to get a sheet of plywood in the back with the gate up, you got a problem.
Hey, this Inland we talked about earlier. I did look this up. Inland was, which was Ryerson, which was Inland, ArcelorMittal, 1998. Yeah. Now they're overseas, right? Who are they? They're someplace.
Yeah, this is all. There are things that we need to have in this country, and really are a you're hosed if it's not kind of situation, and things go unfavorable in some way. I get it that the geopolitical wisdom has always been that if you trade with people, you're less likely to shoot at each other. Okay. I'm good with that, That's not a bad thesis, in fact, because nobody wants to cut off their own revenue stream, right? I mean, that's, you know, that goes into your calculations. However, sometimes people are unreasonable and do unreasonable things, whether it seems to make sense or not.
Well, to a capitalist, it absolutely makes sense. To Z over in China, it sure doesn't.
Well, and you know what? Sometimes people do unreasonable things, whether it's from an objective or subjective point of view. You'd better be able to respond to it if it happens. And that's the biggest issue that I have with a lot of this. But we have hollowed out so much of this, some of it in the name of environmentalism, which is not a bad thing per se. All right, I mean, where I grew up, you couldn't swim in the water. You couldn't, you know, you choked on the air.
The air in Chicago is way better than it was.
Oh, absolutely. People say the air is so terrible and the water quality is so terrible. I'm like, what planet are you from? I'm
compared to
years
what?
Old.
Hey, real quick, yeah. We're gonna have to. I have a. Will not divulge the name, but I was looking at this ArcelorMittal back in 1998, which was about the time. I have somebody near and dear to me whose father worked for Ryerson forever and was very well liked. And at one point, the CEO, the head plant manager, called him in and he says, you know, you need to retire early. And he goes, I don't want to retire early. He goes, I don't want to retire early. And he goes,
I know where this is going.
He goes, I have a feeling that this takeover is not going to be good for people's pension. And I'm just looking out for you.
Get the F out of here, yeah.
And so he retired like maybe 6 months early. And he lived for, you know, however many years, a long time, and got his pension every month. And I think if he'd have stayed another 6 months when the place was shut down, I think he'd have been in the We Screw You column.
By the way, I was talking about this thing with the demographics issue. We are now 18 months into a seriously deteriorating population-adjusted employment rate. As of the last month print was -1.722 million on an annualized basis.
Well,
this is bad. This is very, very bad, Chief.
Yeah, it's the idea with the immigrant population here, you read all kinds of different stuff. Of course, there's, you know, people that are dead set against one person being here, whatever. But I think the latest numbers are somewhat in the neighborhood of people that have come here in the last year. Over half of them have already got jobs.
Yeah, but they can't solve the problem there because the training and educational level is...
No, but what right. they're what they're doing, you know, it's not an ability to work. I mean, not wanting to. And what we don't want to have happen is everybody here so damn long that they end up like everybody else, just doing drugs sitting there.
I mean, there's... but you know what? You cannot take people that currently have a income level of $2 a day, which is the majority of the population of the planet.
Yeah.
All right. And say, okay, by the way, learn to code.
I understand that.
Okay.
But
that's not going to work.
I'm saying that if we look around this city, there is so much stuff that needs to be cleaned, done, you name it. And if we just show up with a couple of buses, it won't solve the world's problems, but it'll solve a problem for a week or two. You got to start someplace.
Chief, only if you produce more than you cost. That's
well,
the key.
We end up. The thing of it is, Carl, we end up, what does it cost to have people not work?
Well, okay, but you started with the people are here.
Well, I'm saying if somebody says, I'll clean a park, I'd rather do that than have the mayor... talking about how it's costing me $5,000 a day to keep somebody here. Have them clean the park, pay them.
I'm not arguing that, okay? I'm just saying that if you start with the premise that, well, we're just going to let everyone in. Now you're
No. I never said that. Never want to do that.
Right.
But what I'm saying is I want to cut out the middleman. if I'm getting the dough from somebody to help these people out, and I've got five, and why do I keep saying about parks to clean? There's all kinds of good stuff to do. And I have five parks to clean. I'm going to put everybody in a bus, and we're going to clean the park, and I'm going to pay them, rather than have somebody in the middle steal the dough for some program, never gets to them.
Well, yeah. Exactly. And I you know, my first question though is always, you came from a third world hellhole.
Yeah.
Which is why you came, right? I mean, that's allegedly anyway. All right. What's the problem with, after you got the freebie handout to stay in the hotel and get fed and everything else, why don't you go pick up all the trash in the street?
Well, I'm saying we can, and as for the whether somebody has a taxable, whether you have a Social Security, you know what? I know a lot about credit unions because my stepfather ran the one at the church, and I took a class at Notre Dame from a guy who wrote the book, The Economics of the Credit Union, the treatise on it. Every one of these places, I'd have a credit union. Whatever you're making, we're putting 15% in here under your name. The day you get the Social Security thing, we're going to send the check.
Right. Well, here's you'll love this. The revisions. June was revised down by 61,000 from 179 to 119.
That's a lot. Well,
July was revised down by 25.
Well, I think we're going to have some more stuff to talk about on Tuesday. The market is actually, the S&Ps are up a buck, so didn't do much for anybody. NASDAQ futures down 39. Everybody thought this was going to be a horrible, horrible number, like negative or something, but it wasn't. So, but we, you know, we're still in a lousy week. So if we don't rally from here, it's still not the best. Carl, take care of yourself. Ricky, nice job. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.